episode of Better World Podcast. Today we're joined by Anja Leiviska, an associate professor in the philosophy of education, specializing in democratic education at the University of Oulu. In her recent research, Anja has focused on philosophical issues concerning democracy and democratic education, particularly in relation to the current challenges facing democratic societies such as political polarization, growing social and education inequalities, and the status of minority and marginalized groups. So welcome, Anja.
Thank you.
And our second guest is Tuija Kasa, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Oulu in the Faculty of Education and Psychology. And Tuija recently completed her doctoral dissertation at the University of Helsinki titled Unveiling Injustices, Revisiting Human Rights, Education's Legal, Political and Moral Ideals in a Non-Ideal World. And based on research, she argues that the lack of human rights education poses a threat to democracy. And today we are here to discuss democracy. So let's begin with Max beginning discussion. Thank you, everyone, for being here today.
Yes, thank you on my behalf as well. And let's first discuss democracy and our present world today. So we would firstly like to ask, what does it mean to live in a democratic society today? And are there core democratic values that we should be protecting more strongly today?
Which one of us should begin? Should I start or?
Go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead, please, Anja. Yes.
I think people often forget what are the benefits of living in a democratic society. For instance, protection of basic individual rights and liberties, freedom of speech, religion, assembly, the right to due process, and at least relative equality among citizens. These are all features that are, I think, are better represented in democratic societies than in non-democratic ones. And I think we become so accustomed to these basic rights that they become, in a way, self-evident to us, which is why the need to sometimes protect democratic institutions and processes is neglected or forgotten. And I guess, in a sense, to your question, what does it mean to live in a democratic society? I guess living in a well-functioning society actually means that we don't really have to think about so much about protecting basic rights or liberties as individual citizens when they are sufficiently realized. So we can live and speak as we like, at least to a certain degree, without constantly fearing about the consequences of our actions, or without having to, for instance, hide our identities for the fear of them not being tolerated within society. But I guess democracies, or at least most democracies, seldom reach this point, at least not for all citizens and residents. Especially inequalities are a persistent issue in most democratic societies, which is why democracy should also be understood as a kind of an ideal that helps us to improve current conditions. Tuija, would you like to say something?
Yeah, I would also emphasize the importance of equality, equity, and justice as these kinds of ideals in the core of democracy. And of course, I have myself studied a lot of human rights, which is really close connected to equality and the idea of protecting everyone's rights. And so that these can realize we need justice and also rule of law. And usually constitutional states are really important. Why constitution protects many basic and fundamental and human rights, for instance, in Finland, but also in many other countries. And something that I have been thinking a lot also is that we are perhaps facing a sort of disillusionment towards these ideals in general, and something that perhaps we could also think about, that what are these kind of minimum principles we want to protect and which are necessary. And some, for instance, I have been inspired by Judith Sklar's philosophy, and she talks about how constitutional democracy is the best way to resist cruelty as this kind of worst form of vice in society. So this is also another perspective to this, protecting the ideals, that we need to also think about the non-ideal and the inequalities that Anja mentioned as well.
Anja, do you have something to add to this?
Well, yeah. we can also think about the core values of democracy through the kind of the very central principle of democracy, which is that everyone who is affected by political decisions should be able to take part in democratic processes. And if we think about what this actually requires, well, it requires that such values as individual freedoms, political rights, and equality are realized in societies to a sufficient degree. So especially such structural inequalities that would prevent some groups, such as marginalized minorities, from political participation are a persistent problem for democratic societies, which is why equality, especially equality from the perspective of the marginalized, is something that should be paid much more attention to and protected as a central value of democracy.
Let's continue and stay on the topic of values and democracy. And when we look at the values of a democratic society, maybe the most important values might be those regarding human rights. And thus we would like to ask, how do you see the relationship between democracy and human rights? And can democracy function without strong human rights protections? Would you, Tuija, like to start?
Yes. Yes, we have been discussing it in our project because we have both like democratic education and human rights education. And typically in Finland, for instance, these have been going together in the government initiatives because both democracy and human rights are so important for the constitutional state. So they are required both for us to pursue inclusive democracy and equality. So for me, the answer is that they are deeply intertwined. But of course, in the scholarly debate, people have different opinions, and some say that these should be like seen as different aspects. And of course, in our different societies, we can have different levels of democratic decision making, and on the other hand, how well human rights are realized. And some might even say that the protection of human rights is not connected to the form of government. But of course, if you think about it, it's really, I think both need each other in a sense that democracy needs human rights, and also human rights needs democratic processes to realize. But yeah, this has been the position we have been taking in the book we have been writing and different articles.
Yes, I very much agree with Tuija that the sufficient realization of human rights is a precondition of a well-functioning democracy. And I cannot really imagine a democratic system in which human rights have not been realized, at least to a certain or sufficient degree. And typically, I think Tuija already mentioned that human rights are legally executed version of human rights on the level of the nation state are typically the basic rights that are articulated in the constitution of democratic states. And these typically also protect the very core values of democracy, such as freedom of individuals and equality among citizens. So also in this sense, human rights are at the very core of protecting the central values of democracy. So I also see these as very much intertwined idea, moral and political ideals and notions. But the relationship the other way around is a more complex one, whether we actually always need democracy for the protection of human rights. That's a more debated issue, at least among scholars. But the other way around, that democracy needs human rights, is a more kind of a consensual matter.
Yeah, and I would perhaps emphasize also that it's a real system of regulation of public law in our society. We sometimes might forget it when we talk about in general level of democracy. And that's why I have been emphasizing the role of human rights education also, that we need to understand the real institutional system so that we can work with it, criticize or do something about the problems.
Thank you. If we talk about your own research for a moment, then Of course, Tuija, in your dissertation, you argue that the lack of human rights education is a threat to democracy. Could you expand on this and also explain what a more robust human rights education system would look like?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, as I said, that because human rights are so at the core of just democracy, it is really crucial that people in general would get this kind of basic knowledge and understanding of the real system, because human rights is part of public law, and they create responsibilities for states and everyone who uses public law or acts for the state, and also teachers, for instance, are one actor who use power in the class or educational institutions. So this is sometimes a neglected approach, and we are not like spelling it clearly enough that what do these responsibilities mean in different levels of education or in society. If we think about healthcare professionals or police, or it's all regulated by human rights, public law, and the constitutional principles. If people do not get this kind of even basic knowledge, then it's really hard to intervene in human rights violations when they occur. And sometimes we usually, maybe when we think about human rights violations, it's something really the moral catastrophes in general and in abroad, but we don't perhaps know this the problems in our own institutions or close to us. So that's kind of the same self-evident thinking that, for instance, in Finland we might have this idea that we don't need this so much, but this is not only in Finland. Many other places have also shown that people always look outside their own context and see human rights violations there. But yeah, it's also human rights education is actually a human right itself. So it's a United Nations regulated human right, and it's really widely recognized across the globe. But the problem I have been addressing in my PhD is that although governments have committed to the idea that everyone should get understanding of human rights norms, principles, values, and that education, for instance, should be organized in a way that it protects everyone's rights and empowers people to protect others' rights as well, if we are not educating teachers about these topics, then it's really hard to realize these legal principles that are actually going through the curricula in Finland, and they are responsibilities of teachers. So, yeah, I think there are many, many threats to democracy, which is really straightforwardly connected to the realization of equality and also on our ability to see inequalities or human rights violations or human rights problems, and we have so much like research and data about the problems that are really persistent in education system and society. If we talk about racism or treatment of indigenous rights or our really persistent ignorance on Sami culture and people, and even the lack of this topic in the curriculum and so on. So it's like it has really far-reaching consequences. It might sound boring for many that we don't need this. We should do something more inspiring, but actually it's at the core of democratic principles. So, yeah.
Thank you, Tuija. Anina, would you like to comment?
One thing that if I can go a little bit back to the question that you asked about the protection of central democratic principles. One thing that we didn't discuss yet is, and this is also connected to the protection of human rights, that currently we are witnessing a significant weakening of many basic individual rights, such as right to abortion or right to freedom of speech and expression in many democratic countries. And I think building a more robust human rights education system as well as democratic education system plays a central role also in protecting these basic civic and human rights. So that's also something that we must think about the current state of democratic, well, actually the whole global order and the democratic states within it when we are building educational systems as well.
Yeah, and if I can like add more concretely about the question of what would a more robust system of human rights education would look like, I think it needs a systematic change in the level of, for instance, higher education, and this could should somehow be done in cooperation of universities, which respects the autonomy of universities, but at the same time, government should be really active, like ministries, that they should provide resources, and it should some kind of that it should be safeguarded that everyone gets the basic principles of democracy and human rights that our government is committed to, and so there are possibilities to work with this, because one of the kind of practical problem has previously been that ministry has said that universities have autonomy and the teaching is research based, which is a good thing, but then we should not forget this kind of it should be not based on individual teachers or teacher educators or researchers' interest that some students only get the good education on these topics. So there are some ideas that should go in all universities across the nation, and yet this is not done. But I hope in the future we could find some ways to improve these issues.
And especially they are not discussed under the specific topics of human rights and democratic education. Issues of equality and injustice are addressed in teacher education, I think, to at least some degree, but to specifically educate educators, future educators, about human rights and democracy, that's very rare in the current Finnish teacher education system and consequently in schools.
Thank you. Actually, I think from here, it's good to move then on to the subject of polarization and inclusion and current challenges of democracy. So, Annina, in your work, you address political polarization. What role does education play countering polarization and fostering democratic dialogue? And as you promised, you will actually open up the concept of polarization a bit more for us as well. So, please.
Yeah, so to understand how can education actually help us tackle polarization, at least to some degree, I think it's important to first understand what we are talking about when we discuss polarization and why it is harmful to democracy in the first place. So if we talk about polarization in a very broad sense, it refers to the political clustering of society that divides population into different groups on opposite sides. And the degree of this polarization is determined between the opposing, concerning the distance between these opposing groups, typically political parties, of course. I think it's important to also distinguish polarization from both political disagreement and political partisanship, which are both normal and even necessary phenomena in democratic society. So there's a unanimous view among theorists that disagreement is necessary for a healthy democracy. And also partisanship, at least to some degree, can be beneficial to democracy. After all, democratic or political parties are the kind of the essential unit of doing democratic politics, and partisanship always plays a role in the formation of political parties. So when we talk about polarization, we typically talk about kind of a persistent division of society that is so deep and so invasive that it begins to harm the democratic system and processes. Polarization operates on this kind of a division between us and them, in which the other group is typically perceived as an enemy. So this is the basic dynamics underlying polarization. And usually there's a division between two different types of polarization as well. So on the other hand, there's ideological polarization, which refers to the kind of a placement of different political views on a certain political axis, such as the left-right axis, for instance. And the more ideologically polarized the society is, the further away the opposing parties or poles are on this axis. This type of polarization is not always or necessarily harmful, because some degree of ideological polarization can even it can mobilize and increase the activity of citizens, because people are, when they see that there's certain clear ideas to be defending or opposing, they are more willing to engage in politics. So it can also have this kind of a mobilizing function. Ideological polarization mostly becomes harmful when one or both of these opposing poles or parties begin to exhibit anti-democratic views and values. So the increasing adoption of anti-democratic views and opinions and attitudes is the threat with ideological polarization. But effective polarization is typically the form of polarization that is argued to be more harmful and which has also been increasing in democratic societies all over the world. And it refers to the kind of the emotional and attitudinal dimensions of polarization, especially the sympathy and positive feelings towards the members of your in-group. And on the other hand, the hostility and antagonism towards those who don't belong to your immediate in-group. So the members of other political parties or party, for instance. And why this type of polarization, especially effective polarization, is harmful? Well, first of all, it is often seen as eroding or even destroying the civic virtues, such as toleration and reciprocity among citizens. And by this, I mean the respect for those who one disagrees or with or who are different from oneself, as well as the ability to cooperate or reach a fair compromise with those who belong to other political groups or parties. So effective polarization may in this sense impair democratic processes and sometimes lead to political dead ends in which no clear compromise or even resolution can be achieved. Some scholars have also argued that effective polarization especially diminishes citizens' ability to form and assess beliefs and form political opinions in a rational manner in processes of decision making. And this is especially because in effectively polarized societies, people tend to form their beliefs not so much based on the content of those beliefs or views, but based on their group affiliation. So based on their membership in a particular political group. And when political opinions and even the assessment of beliefs and information becomes kind of identity bound, it is very, very difficult for people to change their political views, even when they are presented with very convincing counter evidence. So this is one of the problems in effective polarization, that it really affects people's ability to form reasoned views based on which to, for instance, vote or participate politically. Well, if I now move on to how could education then help to tackle these issues with polarization. Well, first, I have to make the kind of a cautionary remark that education is, of course, only one societal institution that cannot solve this problem alone. But I think that education does have a certain like a transformative potential within it, because it involves, first of all, entire generations. And it's especially basic and secondary education is able to address people when they are in a particularly sort of sensitive age and are only forming their views about the society. So it's also a kind of a people don't yet have fixed political identities, for instance. So it's a kind of a preferable time to be influencing the way people think about politics and the society more generally. So what I think on a general level education can do, well, first of all, the kind of a traditional suggestion is that to reduce polarization, the students can be taught concerning skills and attitudes associated with sort of productive democratic dialogue and deliberation, such as mutual respect and perspective taking, toleration towards different political others, as well as how to clarify and structure political disagreement and conflict in a productive way, even if we cannot reach a compromise or consensus. And these skills can evidently be learned only through taking part in political discussion or taking part in discussion on political and societal matters in schools. And this has to be carried out very frequently in schools. Otherwise, if it's only a very marginal part of education, we cannot really expect it to have a significant impact. So this kind of political talk or societal talk should be incorporated as a much more central part of education than it is now. Also, one important aspect of tackling polarization through education is to intervene with persistent inequalities. And education can also play a big role in this, since educational institutions have the power. On the other hand, they can reproduce societal inequalities, but on the other hand, they also have the power to alleviate such inequalities, especially basic and comprehensive education, as well as secondary education. So organizing these on the institutional level in a way that helps to give each student, regardless of the social background, equal educational trajectories is one of the key issues also in preventing the polarization of society. But I have also, in some of my publications, I have also discussed like more detailed strategies concerning each of these forms of polarization, both ideological and effective. So sorry for the long background talk concerning those forms, but there it was kind of needed for understanding these particular types of education that I have been talking about in my research. So as I said, ideological polarization is especially harmful in the case that it leads to the increased acceptance of anti-democratic values in society. So what I have suggested is that education could perhaps function as a means of providing students with these kinds of examples or even thought exercises where students could, either through historical examples of societies where democracy has been eroding or has been replaced with authoritarian government, for instance, or even students could even engage in these kind of thought exercises. What would it mean to live in a Finnish society where, for instance, the basic rights and liberties associated with democracy would not exist? What would it mean if we couldn't influence political decision making in any way, or if citizens weren't represented in a proper way by democratic institutions? What would it mean to students' everyday lives? Because I think teaching about democratic principles and values on this abstract level may not come close enough to students' hearts, but when they are asked to sort of imagine what would it actually mean to their everyday lives and the lives of those living near them, their friends and families, and how would it actually change their everyday lives, I think these kinds of exercises would help students to form a stronger commitment to democratic values. And hopefully also prevent them in the future from adopting anti-democratic attitudes.
Thank you.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry for the long monologue.
No, that was really interesting. I was just going to see if Tuija wanted to comment a little bit.
Yeah, sure, of course.
Yeah, I think it's really important points that you were saying. And I have been thinking on my... I have done some empirical research on teachers or educators, like what do they perceive, for example, as difficult topics, and polarization is one of them. So I'm not sure how well our education system has been prepared for this situation. At the same time, education is an excellent place to practice these kind of issues, and especially in Finland, because people come from different backgrounds in same classrooms, or it's not so segregated. There is, of course, segregation also, which is a problem, but still, in general, there are really good opportunities to discuss in a diverse classroom, in a sense. So it's a great opportunity, but I agree that we need more like education for educators. I now talk a lot about teachers because I'm also a teacher by background, and my research has been a lot about teachers, so because they have so influential role in these topics. But that was the main idea I was thinking.
From that question, let's think about these challenges then. So how should democracy respond to populism and illiberalism, as we discussed earlier? Then at the moment, the world is facing quite a time with a lot of democratic, or a lot of our oldest democracies, seeing rights being taken away, and populism is on the rise, especially in Europe and in Finland as well. And can democratic systems then survive if large segments of the population start to reject them? Who would like to start?
Do you want to start for a change?
These are so big topics, and I have been thinking a lot about the kind of appeal of populism recently, and its strength might be that it provides easy answers to people, and people are then drawn to these simple answers, which is a bit problematic because the truth is that the world is increasingly complex. So would the answer be that we should provide people that they should be more prepared and willing to embrace the complexity? Or should we, as researchers, for example, try to simplify things, like in a more give research based ideas, so that people would be like understand the importance of some basic principles? And perhaps we have failed in a sense to somehow articulate or realize some basic important principles, because people are turning to these really easy answers that actually make things worse at the end. But please, Annina, add something about the populism if you have especially done some research about it. But this is just my reflections recently, that what should we do? But perhaps concerning the illiberalism, I have been thinking recently a lot about the anti-gender movement, for instance, which increases its influence across the world. And related to the previous comment also, that I have been amazed how people are so vulnerable to this kind of fear of that for instance, the traditional gender roles are now collapsing and the world is somehow... It's really the groups who are advocating for anti-gender movement are really afraid of this kind of apocalypse of everything, that the order, every decent order in society is crumbling. And then we have so much research and good research and results, that why this is not the case, but somehow it's not communicated, that people are really vulnerable to these simple ideas or the ideas that are eliminating many groups' rights, which is really worrying. And of course, again, education can and could do a lot, but I fear that we are not prepared enough for this, but we should start doing more. Yeah.
Well, if I continue, I would first like to say that populism, of course, is a very kind of a broad concept, and not all forms of populism are problematic. And it's, I guess it's safe to say that all political parties use populist strategies or rhetoric, at least to some degree. Populism becomes an issue if it feeds into, for instance, polarization, or if populist parties or politicians harbor anti-democratic values and ideals. So that's when populism really becomes problematic for democracy. And I think same holds for illiberalism. For instance, conservative religious views have been a constant topic of discussion in theories of democracy since, I think, from the even the 70s. And especially if the conservative group is not kind of seeking administrative or seeking to influence public administration, the response from theorists is that the probably the safest strategy is to let the group be if it's relatively small and doesn't seek to influence public policy. But of course, if most or let's say half of the population comes to accept anti-democratic values or ideals, then of course they also have the political power to influence public administration, and this is what we are now seeing, for instance, in the US. So it's very difficult to say kind of a general recipe how democracies should respond to these types of groups or ideologies. If the group in question is relatively small, to avoid backlash, maybe strong reactions are even making the situation worse. But to your question, that does democracy really survive if large segments of the population reject the democratic values? Well, what we are seeing, for instance, in the U.S. context now is kind of confirming the negative response. So no, democracies cannot really survive very well if at least half of the population are accepting, at least to some degree, anti-democratic values and ideals. So democracy is, in this sense, a kind of a paradoxical system that it needs to exclude, for instance, anti-democratic values and ideologies in order to sustain itself in the long run. So, and this is why there are also some mechanisms and practices through which democracies seek to protect themselves against these like these types of invasions of anti-democratic ideologies. For instance, the constitution that cannot be changed usually or in most democratic countries by simple majority vote, or in multi-party systems sometimes the other parties, for instance, refuse to collaborate in the government with parties representing anti-democratic views. So these kinds of protective measures are taken by democratic societies, but it really depends on the societal and historical context, what is the best or the working strategy to protect democracy. So a general recipe is really difficult to give.
And I could also say that, like, justice in democracy requires people who can transcend their self-interests in a way that they can act in accordance to the common good as well. And if people start only reacting based on their own self-interest, then we are in trouble, as we are seeing right now. So we, in ideal sense, we should foster this kind of general ability to imagine how other peoples live in society. This has been something that Martha Nussbaum has, for instance, talked about, the role of imagination and empathy in democracy, which is really important. But of course, then because we do not live in ideal or perfect society, then we also need these regulations and protections like human rights that regulate the public use of power. But yeah, in democracy, it's also a vulnerable system in many ways. So it's it's not easy to protect it if too many turn against the democratic principles. And something I have been trying to, as part of my PhD, understand why, for instance, this kind of disillusionment of human rights has become that people don't anymore, or we can talk about this, that people don't perhaps believe in these common values anymore so much. So this requires also taking in account the historical background, the colonial histories, and the history of inequalities that people don't believe anymore when we talk about these nice ideas or ideals. They need to be like realizing in their life in somehow, or you need to have some kind of connection to these principles that they affect my life and I can do something, although the circumstances can be like non-ideal or imperfect. And also the important idea in the core of democracy that it is not a perfect system. It's always incomplete. It's always a contestation. It's always becoming, and we need to work for it every day and reinvent it all the time. So then we might lose it.
Thank you. That's a good comment for the next question, which concerns marginalized people and voices. So are current democratic structures capable of ensuring the inclusion of marginalized voices, or do we need new models? Should we be looking outside of traditional Western democratic systems for inspirations on how to build a more inclusive form of democracy? Would Annina like to begin?
Sure. The inclusion of members of marginalized groups is a kind of a persistent topic of discussion in theory of democracy and in philosophy of democracy in a general sense. Most of the proposals that different thinkers have made concerning how to change the democratic system is to multiply the possible means and forms and forums of participation available. Especially for the members of marginalized groups, and also enable types of participation and expression that are more characteristic to these groups. So essentially, the central message in all of these proposals is that we should listen more carefully what the members of these groups have to say about also the methods of participation that they are both available to them, and that they feel that they can really express their opinions and views through. So democracy in this sense should not be understood merely as a kind of a formal, for instance, voting, or not as a merely a formal process of voting, for instance, but a more broad system in which influencing can take and participation can take very various forms depending on the group. Also, as I mentioned earlier, there's a lot more work to be done to eliminate the kind of structural and practical challenges and barriers that are now preventing marginalized groups' participation in society and political participation as well. Such as racism is, of course, a structural barrier that if we are living in a society with racist structures or practices, we cannot really imagine that racialized groups have an equal standing as democratic citizens, or that they could articulate their views in an equal manner. Yeah, Tuija, would you like to comment at this point?
Yeah, it raises many thoughts, and I think that we should think about global, at the global level, that we should think beyond, of course, Western, so-called Western thinking, then what are the Western democracies? So, and as I mentioned, the colonial past, for instance, and the present, that Western world should be critical of its own heritage, and there is still this kind of epistemic injustice globally that we are not listening for certain voices or perspectives so much, or we don't prioritize them as much. So we definitely in this global interaction, we many of us could learn from each other many things. So and something that would be interesting to think about, that how could we increase this kind of global democracy in a sense, and perhaps in UN, this is something that we are trying to do, but at the same time we all know that there are veto rights, that the whole system would collapse if we would take those away, and then we can think, is it democratic in a sense? Because it many times, if you think about the majority of for instance, countries voting, it might be different than those who have a lot of power. They can sabotage any attempt to advance global justice in many ways. So there is a lot of problems. But perhaps if you think about current democratic structures, they are both in some ways capable of inclusion of marginalized voices. And then on the other hand, as we have been mentioning in many times, the general reproduction of inequalities in society and education hampers many groups' possibilities to influence democratic decision making, and can even cause this kind of that you don't want to or you don't see any opportunities to, you don't want to use any energy to try because you don't believe in your possibilities to act, or that you could have a place or a voice in the sense that you want. So this is a constant problem we need to work with, of course, and this is something that is really important for everyone who is concerned really about democracy, but still it's a never-ending process of trying to imagine new ways and have pluralist dialogues and interactions to think about new ways to include different groups and people, and how can we amplify marginalized voices and or make space for them in the first place, so that no one has to speak for others. And so, yeah.
Annina, do you have any last thoughts on that subject?
Yeah, it's true that what Tuija just said, that for instance, structural racism, according to many studies, leads immigrants to sort of self-withdraw from political participation because they don't feel that they belong to the society or have any voice in the society, or are even seen as members of that society by others. So it's not only that there are kind of concrete obstacles such as language barriers or something like that, or lack of information on behalf of immigrants, but they also kind of, political participation requires a certain degree of a sense of yourself as a part of a political community. And if you don't have that, and understandably, you cannot have that if you belong to a racialized group and live in a society with racist structures and practices. So in that sense, eliminating those is one of the key issues. And yeah, I could briefly also comment on the learning from non-Western views. I think democracy in general is a project that has been criticized for being bound to the nation state in a sense. So in this sense, it's also prone to kind of ignore many important problems such as global inequalities. So yes, I also think that at least regarding certain issues such as human rights breaches or issues of global justice, theories of democracy and thinking about democracy in a more general sense could really benefit from adopting broader and other perspectives as well.
Yeah, thank you. I was thinking immediately of the forum we were discussing on a previous podcast about the role of representation and how if everyone could globally who felt the same be represented. We discussed the possibility of a world state and world government, these types of ideas as well, where people could be connected who feel the same way. And for example, on climate change, if everyone in the globe could vote together, and those types of ideas. But I wanted to ask you just a final question before we have a short break. Was that in Finland, as we currently have an election going on, as we know, but isn't it so that you don't have to be a citizen to vote in these elections that we have in these municipal elections? Is that something that's kind of a rare thing?
Well, democratic societies differ largely on that. So some societies, such as Finland, enable also non-citizens or residents to take part in official political decision-making, but many European countries also exclude that possibility. So, yeah, but that's not really something that is in my expertise, so I don't feel confident to say more about that. Do you know, for instance, what is the situation in other European countries?
Actually, no, I haven't read about it.
Yeah, I was just thinking it's maybe an interesting thing for example, people in the US listening, just the idea that you can actually vote if you're not a citizen. And I think lots of immigrants don't actually have this information. They don't necessarily know that they have this right to vote in these small elections that affect the city they're living in.
And also the ability to kind of, or to have the motivation to vote in this, especially in these smaller elections, you need to have a certain background knowledge of the society and how it works and how these elections can actually influence the life, your everyday life or the lives of your close ones. So being an immigrant and having the kind of the abstract feeling right to vote in these smaller elections, it might be, it's kind of a political effect to the inclusion of marginalized groups might be close to none, because maybe not many, at least those who have been living in Finland for a very short time, probably use the right. I don't know if there has been any studies, or at least I haven't encountered any studies regarding that topic, whether it has been studied how many immigrants actually who don't have citizenship participate in these smaller elections.
Yeah, thank you. I think that was just something that came to mind as we think about democracy and like even these small levels to the global level, then just this understanding and how people can not be included just because they don't understand their rights. And also it must be an issue of representation in Finland as well, that probably they would want to vote for someone who represents them. And it might be very difficult to find candidates who represent them and their interests in these types of elections. But that was just an idea that I thought was interesting regarding the previous question we were discussing. But I think now we'll have a short break, and then in part two, we'll discuss some challenges and then future visions of democracy. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.